Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Episode of At the Margin. Today's intro comes from the Kingdom. You can hear the Kerry waves in the background, the Atlantic waves, I should say. So today's episode is on energy poverty. I have Barra Rowntree and Michelle Barrett and myself discussing a recent paper that we released discussing energy poverty in Ireland, how it has progressed over the past 30 odd years or so, and how recent energy price changes have impacted households across income distribution, with a particular focus on those in energy poverty. This is an interesting chat. We go through the drivers of energy poverty, what socioeconomic groups are associated with more burdensome impact of recent energy price changes. I'll leave it there. I found it an interesting discussion. It's one of the rare occasions where I get to talk about research that I've been involved in. So I felt like I was speaking from the both sides of my mouth at sometimes. But anyway, I hope you enjoy it, and talk soon.
All right, guys. Okay, well, thanks for coming on. And I always say to people who are doing an energy related topic that you have the short straw, because I can answer the questions as well as ask them. But in this case, it's even more the case because I was involved in the project. But so we're talking about energy poverty and deprivation and how, the impact in Ireland and the impact of the recent price changes. And so I suppose the first thing is this project, how did it come about? And this is something that the Community Foundation for Ireland were interested in, and they approached you, Barrett, just to say maybe we should do a bit of research on energy poverty. But I suppose this is something that was of interest before before the recent price changes came about.
Yeah, so I suppose we'd started, Community Foundation for Ireland came to us at the SRI and wanted to see more research done in the area of energy deprivation and poverty. And so I think that was something that already, Niall, you had been doing work on for the Barrington lecture you'd given to the Statistical and Social Inquiry Society of Ireland to get that mouthful out back about a year and a half ago, I think. Was that long ago? Yeah, I think it was that long ago. But so I suppose we knew we'd been doing some work on that, and we'd done some work, I suppose, separately in the tax, welfare and pensions team here at the SRI on kind of carbon taxes and compensation options. And then the Community Foundation approached us. But really, as you say, it was kind of before any of the big increase in prices that this was kind of underway. So it was kind of work that happened to be ongoing, I suppose, at the time then, when it became even more policy relevant. But that's kind of, I suppose, the background to it. But I suppose then what we tried to do in it then was to build on what had been done before. And so maybe the first bit of the report then, it's really about kind of historical patterns of energy deprivation and poverty.
Yeah, so like I suppose the Barrington was more a case of looking at expenditure, so expenditure-based energy poverty. When you measure energy poverty as a proportion of income, how it relates to different socioeconomic groups, who's more inclined to experience this. And then I suppose the idea was to compare that to energy deprivation, where it's a case of, well, if you're faced with burdensome energy costs, who tends to respond by maybe cutting back on it, as opposed to maybe just bearing the brunt of that cost and, maybe cutting back in other ways, other expenditures. What we did there is we took the household budget survey, which was able to tell us about energy expenditure based poverty. So we're looking at expenditure as a proportion of income, who tends to incur that sort of energy poverty, and we compare that then to maybe the SILC, where it's like self-reported measures of deprivation. And Michelle, you did a lot of work there on the self-reported type deprivation. Maybe you could tell us a bit about what exactly self-reported deprivation is. Or
yes, so we looked at we looked at energy deprivation in the Living in Ireland survey and the SILC survey. And basically what they ask there is they ask, are you unable to heat your home due to an inability to afford it, or due to basically lack of adequate infrastructure to heat your home in your house?
So it's a more case of people who can't really afford the adequate heat, or for some reason, maybe perhaps in the structure of the house, can you... do you have problems, I suppose, heating your home?
And even, I suppose, I'll just on the headline rates, one of the things that kind of stood out is that while both energy poverty, as measured by spending more than 10% of your income, including electricity, on those costs, and energy deprivation, which is not being able to afford, as Michelle said, to keep your home adequately heated for either of those reasons, both of those had kind of been declining over the 90s and 2000s. And so we've gotten to... This was just before the recession started, quite a low level, so about 5% on some of the deprivation measures, and then a little bit higher, but a bit over 10% on the energy poverty measures. But then what you really see, and one of the really striking things is that, and kind of, as you say, kind of gets at that, these two measures are picking up slightly different things, is that over the course of the Great Recession, you see a big increase in rates of energy deprivation, which then starts to come back down again after as recovery kind of kicks off, where there isn't that much of a change in the share who are spending more than 10% of their income on electricity, or wasn't over the recession. Now, part of that was, you know, incomes were falling, but also energy prices that fell a little bit over that time and then kind of reversed that. So there's kind of, I suppose, those two measures kind of pick up on different aspects. But again, and Michelle, so that then was talking about some of those groups there that where it does stand out that you know, some groups seem much more at risk of energy deprivation, some groups at risk of energy poverty, and maybe that tells us a little bit different about how about the challenges, I suppose, that those different groups of households face.
Yeah, like, and the thing about it is, like, it's the headline rate and it's descriptive, so it's very hard to actually say precisely why we saw this sort of drop, but it gives you enough, I suppose, foundation to maybe explore it a bit more. And the one question that came to mind to me was, okay, we see this jump during the recessionary period amongst deprivation. We didn't really see it for energy poverty. And, you know, okay, well, the data, we don't get as much data when it comes to energy poverty, so maybe we can't see that as much. But I wonder, is it a case that when you're faced with this constraint, like what you get for a recession, and maybe this is one of the ways people would be tend to cut back. So I wonder if that says something about how people respond when it comes to, you know, faced with a constraint like this.
Yeah, well, we've seen that much of the increase during the Great Recession was driven by increases in the rate of energy deprivation for those not at risk of poverty. And we also seen an increase for renters as well as homeowners, but with renters at a far higher level. And renters tend to be younger, and they might cut back on their expenditure on heat in order to accommodate expenditure on other goods and services. Whereas if you're a homeowner and you have a family, or you're living with an older person, you're thinking of the other people in your household that you're responsible for. So there might be just kind of like generational differences in the types of people that are renters and homeowners as well.
Yes, but one of the things is that also stands out is that, you know, you also see these kind of differences in broader measures of poverty and deprivation. So during, you know, if you look at what's often called the at-risk of poverty rate, and that actually didn't change that much during the recession. And part of that was because middle incomes were kind of falling. So there was, you know, the poverty line was falling, so there was fewer people below it. But had you held the poverty line fixed? But then these are kind of measures of deprivation, which are more, you know, just self-reported things about can you afford to keep your home adequate warm, or, you know, there's broader measures as well in terms of wider material deprivation. And we did also see over the recession, and from that point of view, there was much sharper increase, and that was much more responsive. So that maybe kind of says something about how we measure poverty and how we and how we measure deprivation. But then one, I suppose, the shortcomings of those deprivation measures is that you can't really provide real time. You know, it's harder to kind of simulate the impact of policy measures on those, because you can't kind of construct the counterfactual. Whereas with income, we have tools like the micro-simulation tool here at the ESRI switch, which allows us to kind of say, well, if policy did X, then what would rates of energy poverty be? Whereas you can't really do the same with material deprivation measures, including energy deprivation. So they kind of pointed at interesting and different things, but there's kind of maybe more constraints on what you can do in terms of deprivation, in terms of modelling some of those kind of counterfactual scenarios.
Yeah. So like I suppose the big thing here is you get a survey and it tells you a snapshot of that moment in time. But if you want to project it into the future, it's very easy to project maybe expenditures given certain things change. You can, when you're dealing with numbers, it's very easy to simulate that. When you're dealing with words, it's very difficult to see what the counterfactual is. So if you're looking forward, then I suppose the one thing is you want to be focusing on the numbers. And that's where the next section of the paper was, perhaps to look at, well, this was energy poverty and deprivation maybe historically, going back way back to the 90s and up to maybe 2015, 2016. And we saw these patterns as they went through those periods. And then we want to see, well, what does it look like now, maybe 2022, or as close as we can get to 2022. And that's where you did all the sort of magic trickery pokery with the micro-simulation, Barra. Maybe do you want to take us through what sort of method, how you sort of operated maybe the expenditures from the last snapshot we had in 2015-16 to maybe what we had in more recent times?
What the part of the report, and this maybe part of the report that's picked up most in the media last week, was about trying to kind of look at a now cast of where are rates of energy deprivation now, and what have recent price increases done to both those levels of energy poverty, but also the impact on people's households. And one of the downsides there in terms of the data that's available is that the last household budget survey was collected in 2015-16. And now since then, lots of stuff has changed. We've had several years of income growth. So 2015-16, we were still recovering from the recession. Incomes were still below their pre-recession peak. Now they're, or by the stage of the pandemic at least, they were above that. So I suppose there was kind of a lack of any real-time information or information, later than 2015-16 about the levels of energy poverty. Energy deprivation, we had some more recent information collected in SILC, but only really running up to 2020, so before the current onset of prices. So again, really for policymakers, I suppose they need to be in a position where they have some idea of, well, how large are these impacts, not just on average, but across different types of households, and who are those households who may be worst affected, and what does that maybe tell us about how we might want to design the policy response? So that was really where this kind of report was motivated at, trying to address those questions. And the way we did that then was to, again, rely on SWITCH, the ESRI tax and benefit micro-simulation model. And so what we did in terms of that was to take the latest data that we have running with SWITCH, which is the 2019 survey data, but then upgraded to 2022 terms, and then impute into that levels of expenditure. So kind of take the previous relationship between levels of income, demographics, and patterns of spending, impute into our SILC data levels of expenditure, and then use that and the kind of more up-to-date kind of demographic and income information that we have in that to be able to say, well, given those imputations, what of the and predicted levels of expenditure, what would have recent price increases done? And so then what we took, the way we calculated that was to take the recent CSO sub-indices for various prices of energy types, and then look at the changes in those, and then again, taking the predicted levels of expenditure, which line up very well with what they kind of had been in 2015-16, well, who would have been those groups that are most impacted, and what's the kind of the weekly or the annual loss in terms of the change in prices brought about, assuming that behaviour remains constant. And that kind of, again, is maybe provide some of those headline figures that we had in the report, which is about, you know, recent price increases, for example, leaving households on average 22 euro or 21 euro a week worse off in terms of the price, the amount that they our estimated spend expenditure and the price increases amounting to about that. On average, I think that came in about 2.3% then of household income, of their disposable income, the net after tax and transfer income. And then again, we could look at the gradients in terms of the effects on that. So higher for lower income households, for rural households, for older households. And again, all of that then kind of pointing towards, well, what might you think about that in terms of informing a policy response?
Yeah. And just to go back a couple of steps, just on the methodology. So for maybe there's some sort of data nerds here. One of the nice things though that you have in the switch model is like, usually you look at, you have maybe the EU Silk data, and that's a lot really good data on incomes and taxes and all that sort of stuff, and more on living conditions, but more focused on maybe the household incomes as opposed to the household expenditures. But you've matched that up, imputed expenditures within that data set, so you have a methodology to sort of bring that in the one platform, so you can look. That helped with this analysis, I suppose.
Yeah, and I suppose that's one issue that lots of kind of the household, detailed household income surveys like Silk have had over recent years, is that they don't collect information on expenditure. And that limits what you're able to say about indirect tax changes, for example, if you're interested in looking at them, or price changes in terms of inflation or specifically energy. And so really what we did was we adopted an approach that had been undertaken in the literature. There's, you know, lots of assumptions and caveats kind of built into it, but broadly speaking, gets you a kind of a distribution of expenditure that matches what we think it should look like, and then allows you to take that and do then simulations of the impact of various price changes or the impact of policy responses, taking into account, I suppose, and up to date the latest information that we have in Silk. So again, it's the type of thing that policymakers find very very useful. There's, you know, it's not particularly maybe novel in terms of the methodological contribution or the kind of the research thing. There's kind of, you know, lots of papers have tried to do this over the years, and we're just kind of following them and doing that, but really trying to get it up to the minute and to be useful then for policymakers to consider their responses.
So at that point, you have, like, in the one data set, like, this is crucial for the analysis like this. You have one data set, you have profile of households, you have profile of representative profile of their incomes, and then representative profile of their expenditures, and then you can bring in the new price, update the prices up to the present day with the method that you just described, and then see how it affects different households and different income levels and different groups and like socioeconomic sort of breakdown and things like that. Was there anything, Michelle, can you think of anything that struck out to you as being particularly interesting or insightful in terms of the distribution of the effect?
Well, in terms of one thing that struck me was that rural households were much more affected when motor fuels were accounted for. We see that as an impact of their weekly disposable income, that it accounts for 10% of their weekly expenditure, whereas for urban households, it accounts for 26%. So there's nearly 4% difference between urban and rural households. And in terms of public transport, perhaps rural households don't have the same options available to them that urban households would have in order to mitigate the impact of increasing prices of motor fuels.
One thing that maybe just to build on that, one thing that's come out in previous ESRI research, so work by, I think, Sean Lyons and Richard Tull and others, and then also we picked up something in a previous paper looking at the carbon tax. But amongst those urban or those rural households who are particularly badly impacted, most of that kind of higher average loss tends to come from those who are driving quite far distances. So if you kind of, you know, if you look at the number of kilometres that the households who are worst impacted are driving, unsurprisingly, it's a very large share. So they look like they're living in rural areas, commuting long distances, so not just to Dublin, but to Limerick or to Cork or to Galway, seems to be the most part. And again, that previous ESRI research has looked at that more specifically about the commuting patterns and showing that there are these kind of subgroups in rural areas who drive very far. So the people in rural areas who are just, I suppose, going around, going down to local town or village or shops, they do drive more, but really they're not kind of as adversely impacted by the by say carbon taxes or by fuel prices. It's where really those heavy losses are being driven by are those people who are driving the far distances. And then in a way that's kind of, you know, if we move to this new world of work where people are able to drive less far, there's going to be some people, not everyone, but there's going to be some of those people who are able to maybe mitigate how much they have to drive, either by virtue of being able to work from home or in a local hub or whoever. But then there's going to be other groups who aren't, right? And I suppose kind of bearing in mind the heterogeneity and the variation within, you know, it's not a homogenous group of rural households and urban households. There's kind of groups within each of those where some are more affected than others. And again, thinking about why the reasons for that is and what then might be the best. But what then that tells us about how government should respond is also kind of something to I suppose, the report gives a bit to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're moving on to maybe further research. But one thing that's interesting there is that you have certain people who have to drive longer distances, maybe for work. But I wonder how that's correlated with income then. So the people who are driving further, are they more likely to have more higher incomes or not? Maybe if you're travelling to Dublin, you'd imagine incomes might be higher, but... that's not necessarily going to be the case, but
And there'll be many people, particularly maybe say they're working construction on a project on a site that's very far away, and they might have to go far, or working in hospitals or the like, which tend to be congregated in maybe more urban settings. So there's going to be really a range across there. So there'll be some higher income folk, I suppose, who are driving far distance, but there also will be many others who aren't. But then again, that kind of, you know, the extent to which people are able to switch, there's probably also likely a correlation with income there, right? And that the type of service jobs which are more readily able, remotable, if that makes sense, are maybe likely to be the those higher income ones, whereas the ones where there is less scope for switching is perhaps, at least in the short term, are maybe those people working in hospitals or the types of jobs which are located in an urban area but aren't so remotable.
That's a very interesting point. It would be interesting to see the census data on travel to work.
And that's going to be really exciting, I suppose, as that data comes out, because again, the data that we have been relying on, particularly at the census level, is pre-COVID, and we don't really fully know how people's patterns of work or even accommodation have changed in response to those. You hear anecdotally of many people living back where maybe their parents are from or where they're from originally, but we don't really know the extent to which that's happened. And I suppose the census is going to be our best source of data for looking at that and how that's changed. But again, that'll only tell us relative to 2016, so we won't be able to pinpoint the impact of the pandemic, but there will be more information from that, and that'll be really interesting to see.
Michelle, did you have some thoughts on that, I wonder?
Yeah, so just in terms of the distributional impact, we see that as a percentage of their disposable income, those in lower income quintiles were much more adversely affected, whereas in terms of absolute income, it was those at the higher income quintiles. But these people, they have higher incomes, perhaps they're better able to absorb the cost of increasing fuel prices, whereas we see, because it's more of their disposable income for the lower income groups, it's impacting on their daily life perhaps more. So we see motor fuel costs are incorporated, that 5.9% of the after-tax and transfer income of the lowest income fifth of households is impacted, compared to 3.1% of the highest income fifth. So there really is a strong distributional impact of these rising costs.
Yeah, and the big thing here is it's as a proportion of income, I suppose. So like whilst you have maybe those who are more well off tend to drive a bit more or tend to bigger houses that need more heat, this sort of thing, when you take it as a proportion of income, which is more of a measure of the burden, it's felt more harshly maybe on those who are in lower incomes. So I suppose that's thinking about the gradient. But the other aspect then is maybe when we talk about energy poverty and the numbers who are in energy poverty, and maybe it's worth sort of refreshing what we mean by energy poverty. So one thing about energy poverty is there's many ways to quantify it and to look at it, and there's a whole, like, you could spend the whole time talking about how do you measure it and what's the best way to measure it, and no matter what way you measure it, you're going to capture some households and you're going to maybe leave out some households. And I think the best way to to think about it is not necessarily the X amount or an energy poverty. It's more a case of this has changed by a certain amount, therefore it gives us an indication of the direction of travel and maybe the magnitude of that direction. So the measure we use is 10% income threshold, so 10% of your disposable income or more spent on energy services in the home. And when we talk about energy, we mean solid fuels, gas or electricity. It doesn't include motor fuels, so it's more focused on maybe heating and other sort of services within the household. And if it's more than 10% of your disposable income, well, then you're deemed to be in energy poverty. And this is like, this is a very transparent metric. It's one that's probably one of the early first metrics that was brought into play. And it's one that most people can readily understand. But I suppose the big thing, the big finding is that it's changed by such an extent from the 2015-16 figures. Barry, do you want to take us through maybe how things have changed?
So as you say, that, you know, there's a load of different ways you can measure this, and in a way all these measures can have a shortcoming, but again, what's kind of, I suppose, key is just how much is the change rather than the level necessarily. And so what our estimates and simulations suggest is that whereas back in 2015-16 it was about, you know, 13% or so who had spent more than 10% of their disposable net income on these energy services. If we look at that kind of figure for now, taking into account the price increases that we've seen up to April, we estimate that that is more like 29%. So, you know, whether, you know, the baseline is, you know, it will capture some people who maybe spend a large amount heating their home, or because, you know, they run a lot of electrical appliances because it includes electricity, leaving and then might also exclude some people who don't spend more than 10% because they can't afford to, and they can't afford to keep their home adequately heated, even spending, that amount. So really, then, what I think the key takeaway and that we're trying to highlight is that just how big that increase has been over such a short period of time, and it, you know, so that is really down to the increase in energy prices we've seen in recent months, which are really, really sharp by both, I suppose, you know, historical standards. Kerosene has always jumped around with the price, like it fell dramatically during the start of lockdown, then it kind of bounced back, and has, you know, that's been the largest increase seen in that, which also goes some of the way to explaining the impacts on rural versus, I suppose, urban households. But then we've also seen these big increases in electricity and gas prices of kind of, you know, more than a third, almost by half for electricity through to April, and gas prices just above that. And so these really big price increases are undoubtedly impacting on households' incomes. And, you know, if we take that measure of energy poverty, which again the government has kind of used fairly regularly over the past few years, it does suggest that there is a big increase in the share of households who are experiencing some kind of hardship or a burden of those costs on their in terms of being able to heat their home.
So, okay, I suppose the final step then of the paper was to sort of think about, we have this increase in energy poverty. These costs are substantially burden on a certain proportion of households. How do we best address this? And when I think about like the energy crisis, like I think about it in three sections. I think about it in short, medium and long term. And in medium and long term, you know, it's more a case of, how do we sort of maybe move away, diversify away from fossil fuels? How do we maybe try and bring energy prices down so that they're, we pass the peak and it's more at a more sustainable level? And that's probably a case of, well, in the medium term, diversifying away from or finding new supplies to fill the gap when it comes to, we're no longer getting a lot of our fuels from Russia. But in the longer term, then it's perhaps diversifying away from fossil fuels altogether. But in the short term, we're hit with this shock. It's very hard to dig up pipes and move them around. We're stuck with this supply shock. And then it's a case of, this is what, I suppose, the country has to bear. How do we distribute that? And maybe the policy priority in that circumstance is a case of, well, we want to make sure that everybody has enough resources to meet their basic needs, and one of those being to heat the home. And so, Barry, do you want to take us through maybe the methods and the things we look at?
Really, it's worth thinking about, well, what's the medium to long run response and what's the short term? And in a way, I suppose it'd be good if the short term response doesn't make the medium to long term response harder. And from that point of view, then, one of the things that you maybe, and when we kind of maybe spend quite a lot of time on this in the paper talking about, well, why you might want to avoid cutting indirect taxes on fuel. And so one reason for that is that you kind of weaken the incentive to get that adaption to diversify away from the fossil fuel sources towards maybe more green energy sources, but also then in terms of the energy saving technology in the home or even energy saving behavior. If you're cutting indirect taxes, for example, fuel, VAT on fuel or excise duties, you're really kind of dampening down and weakening that price signal and the information in that price signal that's been sent out. So in a way, that's one reason in of itself to stay away from those kind of indirect tax cuts. But a second and one things that we kind of point on the paper is that, well, they're not particularly well targeted to those being worst affected. So as Michelle mentioned, that's lower income households in particular are worst affected. But if you were to cut VAT on on energy and electricity, or you were to cut fuel duties, really what our research shows is that actually in cash terms, a large share of that cost is made up by compensating high-income households. And the reason for that is simply those high-income households spend more on fuel, so they tend to have larger houses and so spend more in absolute terms on heating, even though it's smaller as a share of their income, but they spend more on that, or they drive more kilometres because they tend to go more places or have more cars and so tend to drive more combined kilometres, I suppose, in the household. And so, from that point of view, as in terms of targeting cutting indirect taxes on fossil fuels, it's just not very well targeted towards those who've been most impacted. So it does provide them with some support, but you end up, for a given cost of a package, much more of that going towards those groups being less affected. Indeed, we estimate, I think, more than half of the cost of cutting fuel duties, of cutting VAT on energy and electricity, that really goes disproportionately to a large share of that towards those higher income groups, and so leave you with less to target or support those at the bottom of the distribution, where, as you kind of say, Niall, that you might be more concerned about the being able to have money for the bare necessities of life. And similarly, we know from research the central bank and others have done that also higher income households tend to have more savings accumulated and so have a bit of a financial buffer there, which tends not to be the case for those at the bottom of the distribution. So there isn't necessarily savings that can be drawn on, or a huge amount of savings that can be drawn on. So that if then it is your goal or your objective to protect those being maybe most affected and have least capacity to adapt, that does suggest that you might want to maybe target those measures, and then in doing so, that providing support through indirect tax cuts is not a particularly sensible way forward. And so instead then we point, and maybe Michelle can say a bit about this, about the alternatives that the government might look at, so be that kind of more changes on the welfare side of things or the direct tax system.
So we looked at Christmas-style social welfare bonus, which we saw this benefited those in the lower income quintile and those at risk of poverty, because their incomes tend to be lower, and these are the groups that we want to target because they're more at risk of feeling the burden of energy poverty. Same with the doubling of fuel allowance. This benefits people with lower incomes, and perhaps not as well targeted as social welfare bonus, because it's long-term recipients of social welfare that can claim the fuel allowance. And also we looked at the energy credit, similar to what the government have already done. And we see that this, as a portion of income, it benefits those with lower income quintiles more. But in saying that, doubling of fuel allowance or Christmas style bonus actually costs less than the €200 energy credit. So in terms of value for money, those first two policies might be better suited.
Oh, it's interesting, because I think it's intuitive for a lot of people to think of, well, if we adjust the price, it brings us back to where we were, and therefore that's what could be a good idea. But we'll come back to the efficiency effect in a minute, but as you're saying, that tends to, like, it's not without cost. Somebody has to foot that bill, and it's public sector or public money that sort of foot that bill, the taxpayers' money. And that the benefit of that then more greater majority of in terms of euros goes towards those who are more well off. So through the tax welfare system helps to target those who need it the most. And as you're saying there, Michelle, using some of the tools that are there perhaps helps target those who need it the best.
Yeah, and I suppose, again, it goes saying, like, we have quite a sophisticated tax and welfare system that's been developed over a long series of time. Like, sure, there are shortcomings and areas it doesn't reach, but, you know, that can be used to much more accurately target the groups who are disproportionately affected or are most in need of the support. Whereas maybe if you're thinking of countries where maybe they haven't got as well-established tax and welfare systems, maybe then it might make a bit more sense to think, well, okay, maybe we should just look at some kind of cut in VAT or food, like those duties. But given we have the tax and welfare system that we do, which really is quite sophisticated and can be kind of adapted readily enough, as we saw during the pandemic, to really provide support to those households and individuals who particularly needed at a point in time, again, this research really does kind of go to show that maybe offers a means of providing that support while mitigating the risk of fueling further inflation, which is something on policymakers' minds, and understandably that, you know, as you said at a minute ago now, like the government, you know, you can't really compensate all households for the entirety of the loss. It's kind of a change in prices, which leaves us as a country worse off because we import the vast majority of our fossil fuel. And so really what the government has to decide is how to distribute that loss across the population, or how to mediate the distribution of that loss. It's not deciding it in full or perfectly, but it can mitigate that, it can mediate it. And from that point of view, having a sophisticated tax and welfare system is really gives the government actually quite a lot of tools and options to think about how to do that.
We're getting into the nuance here, I suppose, but some of the transfers that you discussed, like, it does a pretty good job of targeting most people who are adversely affected, but there are maybe a few groups that perhaps aren't recipients of certain benefits. And there's some insight into how they might be targeted, I think, as well.
Just in terms of long-term trends, we've seen higher rates of fuel deprivation, say, for renters, and also during the Great Recession, we've seen that much of the rise in deprivation rates were driven by those not at risk of poverty, and that's energy deprivation rates. So a good way to target these groups is through the PRSI credit. And this is because you start paying PRSI before you start paying income tax. So by increasing the PRSI credit, you're disproportionately benefiting renters because these people tend to be younger, they tend to earn less, and you're targeting those in the second, third, and also the fourth income quintiles, which aren't as well targeted by the social welfare system.
Yeah, and that's a good bit up the distribution as well when you're targeting these sort of households as well. So that captures a good chunk of the cohort. One thing as well, I suppose, it's somebody who comes to these things through an energy lens, it makes a lot of sense to not distort prices, because one thing, like, we're a long way away from a supply shortage, but one thing that helps us with that is the fact that people are more conscious of the high prices and perhaps are cutting back a little bit. There's a bit of a demand response there, and it's better to have that on your side than maybe to adjust prices and then bring us that step closer maybe to, if there was another shock or something like that, it's just another tool that you don't have in your arsenal.
Yeah, and this is something I think now that maybe some non-economists often miss. They kind of go, well, you know, why does it matter if you're giving people money to compensate them for a loss? Sure, they're just going to spend it on fuel anyhow, and so what's the matter? But I suppose really the point there is that there's a income and substitution effect, right? And you want to almost, given what's happened is out of our control, and we want to adapt in the long run and move away from fossil fuels, we want to kind of keep that substitution effect in play, but rather give people the money to, if we're worried about their capacity to absorb that change in prices or to maintain the basic level of living standards that we as a society think is essential, you want to kind of provide them with the income that they can still do that, but that for those who can afford to switch away, that they do. And that's again why it's maybe just a better idea to provide that support through the welfare system, or you know, lump sum payments, or even the tax system, rather than in changing those relative prices and trying to reverse the change that we've seen. Because again, there are some people in the country and indeed the economy as a whole where you do want them to adapt to that price and use less. And that's kind of with information that's what the price is telling us that we should be doing. There's some informational content there that we don't want to lose by kind of trying to offset it.
And in the long term, it can be, once you've removed the VAT tax or reduced the VAT tax, it can be difficult to reintroduce it. It can be politically unpopular. So there is a risk of that happening as well, that the tax is not returning.
I suppose maybe just to say that, you know, this is just what our report last week was just one in a huge range of ongoing research projects at the ISRI looking at issues related to, I suppose, climate change, on energy prices, on energy systems and adaption. And it really is like a big part of the work that is going on at the ISRI at the moment. Just to flag some of the work now that you and others at the ISRI are doing, not just those who kind of like dip our toes in for the price increases or carbon tax things every now and again, that some of you people are kind of doing lots of ongoing stuff. So you know, if you want to tell us about some of the work that's kind of ongoing there.
There is some work ongoing to try and look at energy poverty in a more detailed way. Like, one of the missing pieces here is that we don't know a profile of the efficiency level of the house. If you add in that piece alongside the sort of income stuff that we're doing here, well, then you can really understand maybe perhaps what is the best response. For example, is it a cash transfer? Is it an income constraint that's going on here? Is it more of a case that it's a, you know, building materials constraint? And then you can sort of target the intervention. You can target the cure that best suits the illness, I suppose. And that's something that's really difficult to understand, is that to what extent is it, you know, buildings versus income that drives these sort of problems. And hopefully we can get a better handle on that. But thanks, Barra, for that prompt.
Always happy to help you flag your ongoing research.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, maybe. It might be podcast worthy. We'll see how that goes. Okay, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us on, Al.
Yeah, thanks very much.